going. Okay, so let's get going. This graph is interesting. So this is just the number of people in the class. These are the number of people that took the test, right? So we have 80. We still have some people still needing to take the test. And this is the percent calculated with the 80 points, you know, 80 divided by 80 times 100, you know. So if you got the perfect score, you got 100%. This is just the distribution within the class. Average is 78%. That's pretty high. But I told you we've tried to make a relatively easy exam for the first test to try to buffer some of the lab grades that some people have. Good job. If you look at that distribution, you know, it's pretty tight all throughout, right? So there's a little drop at the end. If you scored down in here, you might think about we need to make some appointments to figure out what's going on because we want you to beef it up, right? And if there's some content problems or maybe you messed up the Scantron or something, that could happen too on the Scantron sheet, maybe you're in bubble off, but so that's why I hand back these things and I hand back your exam. So in lab, you go over the exams, and then you can double check things, make sure I didn't miskey something. That could be a possibility also. So that's what we're going to do in lab. People that had lab yesterday, was it okay? Yeah? Kind of fun, right? Not so bad. And we got out an hour early, I think. So for today's class and Wednesday's class, you can see what to expect. So it was kind of fun. Pretty quick. But we're going over the exam too and then answer any questions that you have or misconceptions, things like that. Okay, so that's this. We're still cruising on sensory transmission, and so let's keep going. And lots of fun things to talk about with sensory. So, and we're going to do sensory activities in the lab, right, to kind of re-emphasize some of these main points. So the lab content that you have this week, because we do meet for labs, and if you can't meet like today, you can go to Wednesdays, and if you want to switch around on the lab time, that's fine with me too, right? You know, just that we're going to it and kind of getting the content. So sensory transmission, we talked a little bit about that. It's amazing, right, what you sense in the environment as well as internally. So this is a long chapter, this chapter, if you're using that textbook, and there's a lot of content in there, but don't get lost in the forest, right? Kind of keep the big picture. And there's a lot of little snips of information. But it's kind of like, what's the take home here? What's the take home here? What's the take home here, right? And that's the main part. So when we talk about sensory nerves, remember the sensory endings are like a dendritic, you know, arborization, right, on a neuron. But instead of calling them dendrites, we call them sensory endings, right? Because they're monitoring the sense. But they act like a dendrite in your brain in the sense of a graded response, get to threshold, and boom, fire the action potential, right? And the sensory receptor might be a chemical sensory receptor. It might be something that stretches stretch-activated channels, right? Right? Or temperature, something like that. And so we'll cover through that content, but don't get lost with understanding that. So we consider this as a transduction process. So if we have a question that says, how do we transduce that sensory signal, like touch, what are we going to answer? I kind of gave you a hint already. Touch, how we transduce that into the sensory signal? Stretch-activated ion channels, right? And so you deform that membrane, and you transduce that mechanical energy into this electrical signal. And that's pretty amazing to think you take mechanical information and turn it into electrical signal. All right, so we'll go through some examples of this, and it's really quite interesting throughout the whole process. And if we don't just consider ourselves, but you look at the whole animal kingdom, it's really amazing what other animals can sense that we don't sense, such as magnetoreceptors, right? Magnetic fields, electroreception, right? Now, I'm sure if we electrically shock you, you'll fear it, but, you know, the electric field that's around you, some animals can sense that very well. You might have, you know, think about like that we mentioned before, the shark, right? The shark is supposed to be very sensitive to blood, but it's not really the blood. Supposedly it's electric field that is leaking out of an animal that's injured. And they've done these really nice studies with sharks in Florida where they put little electric, like, cathodes and anodes in the sand, buried in the sand, and they can turn it on and see that shark swimming around, and they go right for that because they can sense that electrical field. Really very sensitive. And so that's kind of interesting. There was a guy in Taiwan that emailed last year. He was very interested in the olfactory responses that might be given out of this kind of clam that is buried in the sand, and then it puts its little siphon up to get water. And he was wondering, you know, how do we study the chemosensory of this clam that's pulling in water, and how do the sharks find it? Because they can go right down to the sand and, like, pull out this clam and then chew it up and somehow get out the meat and spit out the shell. I said, are you sure it's really chemosensory? It's probably electrosensory. And so he went ahead and put these little cathodes and anodes in, and he said, wow, they really sense that. It's not the chemical. But you see, that misconception is always out there. So think about, you know, how sensitive they are to this. And when we refer to nociceptors, these are pain receptors, right? Pain receptors. So why I mention that is that on exams in the past, people get confused with that. And they said, well, I thought it was pain, but what's nociceptive? I've never heard of nociceptive. So nociceptive pain receptors. Some people say nociceptive with invertebrates. Where's the problem with that? That invertebrates have nociceptive pain, like your crayfish when you know.
Regenerate?
Okay. Oh, well, the tissues are, you know, it can regenerate the damage, but you can regenerate your skin if you damage your skin, too. So that's a good point. Let's think about this. How are we defining these things? How do we define mechanosensory? How do we define thermosensory? How do we define pain?
What the specific stimulus is.
Yes, what the stimulus is, but then how you perceive it, right? So we perceive pain because, ouch, that hurts, right? But how do you test that from a fly or a crayfish? Do you look for tears out of its eyes? How do you define that? So that's something that really to think about. You know, what would you say? How would you do this? NIH wants to give you $1 million. You want to study pain reception and fruit flies, for example, because then you can knock it out and maybe use opioids or something like that.
I'm not sure how feasible this would be, but if it were, you could look at what parts of the brain light up when someone that we can ask, hey, does this hurt, or feels pain, and then see if those similar regions in the brain and a invertebrate light up when you expose it to the same stimulus.
So, good point. Maybe you could look at the brain and see what's activated and if the regions of the brain with a mammal like us, and an invertebrate. Where do you think the fallacy might be in that point of the invertebrate brain to the human brain? But it's a good idea. And there's a lot of similarities, but we don't know enough about the invertebrate brain, right? And so, yes?
I guess it's just another idea. Mm-hmm. You could look at, like, behavior. They're going to try to avoid the stimulus. It's probably not comfortable for them.
Very good. Maybe avoid the stimulus, not comfortable. So if it's warm in here or cold in here, you might put your jacket on or take it off, right? But is that pain? Yeah. I mean, so these are good points. And this is the debate that's in the literature, right? This is a constant debate worldwide, really. Probably not in countries where they're worried just about getting food, but in places that where your bellies are full and you can worry about other things, right? So people wonder about this. And this is really important because, like in Europe, right now, in Switzerland, they banned boiling lobsters. Because, why? They say they sense pain. How do you know that they're painful? They avoid the stimulus. So how do you do this? How do you deal with this? In Europe, in England, for example, they don't want to have shrimp anymore because of the way that they're processed. They say it's a painful process. The process is collecting them from the field when they're raised, like shrimp farms. You raise them, and you put them in ice water, and then they jump around. That's interesting. So they jump around, so they might avoid it, right? They might avoid this painful, cold stimulus, and then they break the head off and then, you know, ship them, or they just freeze them after they're frozen. Depends on how you get them, or maybe just the tail. So the workers they think maybe they're painful. Right? Because they're jumping around. Interesting phenomenon. What you can do is to take a shrimp, these shrimp on these farms that are like in South America or Central America, you can cut the abdomen off the cephalothorax, which is the head and the body cap, the body part, and just have the tail. So you can cut that quickly with a pair of scissors, throw the tail in the water, in the ice water, and guess what it does? Tail flips. So does it sense pain? Does the tail sense pain? See what I mean? So this is an issue that has affected the food industry and millions of dollars, right? And the way people are setting government laws. So pain reception is something that's still debated in the literature. Do Drosophila feel pain? Do your fruit flies feel pain? When you kill that cockroach next time, how are you going to kill it, you know? Actually, they found out probably the quickest way to incapacitate the animal, to shut down the nervous system like crayfish and lobsters and shrimp, is to put them in boiling water, because it's the fastest way to shut down the nervous system. And some studies have been done in Germany where they've actually raised the temperature slowly, and actually then their nervous system shuts down, so when you do put them in the boil, they can't measure any neural activity. So maybe the other way is better, actually heating up slowly and then just boil it. Maybe that's better. Because if you ice them, you get some activity of the nervous system, and then it shuts down. So you see the interesting things there? So, you know, it affects your food, and some people don't want to eat the animal because of the kind of the processing of things. So it's interesting to think about, right? Because it does affect. A paper just came out yesterday. Anybody getting Science Daily? Science Daily? Should just go for it. Science Daily is fantastic. You know, get that morning science articles that are coming out worldwide and all the different journals, and then you're just like, wow, that is so cool. So they now have a blood test that they're using on humans to sense how sensitive they will be to pain, or if they're really in pain. Like right now, you're entering the ER, and you have a broken leg, you've been out bicycling, you fell off your leg, and you broke your leg, and you're in the ER, and they're going to have to give you some pain medication to fix your leg. But they inject the pain medication, doesn't really touch you. Inject some more because maybe you're an opioid user, right? And so the problem is in the hospitals and in ERs and things like that, they're having to jack up that pain medication so much because people are on pain meds, maybe legitimately or not legitimately, and the pain meds they give them don't touch them, right? And so they have to jack it up even more. What's the problem with that? Jack it up so much, respiration might go down, right? Are other side effects. So they have to keep that balance, right? And of course, the patients are going to lie to you, right? So no one says they're on the meds. So these are issues to think about. But they now have what they've went through to take a blood test, and they're looking for these markers so they can tell if you've not just on opioids and things like that, but other indices for pain. And so that's pretty cool. That's out there now too. So these are new things that are coming out. Kind of stay alert. Science Daily is really cool, you know. I try to get you all interested. If you're interviewing for med schools or allied health programs, and they say, what interests you today? What's new in science? What are you going to say? I don't know. You know, no, you got to, you know, get excited about some new things that are out there, okay? So that's pretty neat. I'm trying to get you to think about things and keep you self-motivated. Okay, so thermoreceptors too. We're going to do some of that in the lab, and some chemo and mechanosensory. Photoreceptors are just amazing if you look across the animal kingdom. So some really neat aspects that we'll try to cover. So do remember, when we talk about senses, it's not just external senses, also internal senses, right? Your body temperature, your osmoregulation, your pH, your proprioceptors. And we have a little exercise with proprioceptors, but we'll go over that today too. So pretty neat things to think about. Some of them are so sensitive, it's really quite amazing. I mean, you just take a single hair on your hand or your arm and move that single hair, right? You can feel that. I mean, that's amazing. One little hair, right? That's amazing that you can feel that, right? That you can tell that sense. And then think about your status at that time. If you were out running or jogging and you had a little paper cut, you might not even feel it, right? You're not paying attention to it at all. But if you're sitting still and you're studying your animal phys, and you turn that page because you're so excited what's on the next page, and you cut your finger with that paper cut, you really pay attention to it, right? So it's kind of your perception at that moment in time, too, right? So some people, you've probably seen it on TV, the little kid's going to get a shot, right? And they don't want the shot. They're going to be crying. They're going to feel that shot. So what they do is they maybe hit him somewhere else, right? They feel that, and they're like, oh, why'd you hit me? And then, boom, they gave him the shot. They don't even know they got the shot, right? Because they paid attention to the other little hit, right? So these are kind of things that are really quite interesting. So very practical as well. Okay, and then we think about what you perceive. Perception is so amazing, right? What you perceive is different than what someone else might perceive. You might be colorblind, the next person might not be, right? You might have night blindness, and the other person doesn't. You might be more sensitive to temperature, and the other person's not, right? So everybody's perception is different. That's why pain, too, if we go back to pain, they don't say, you feel pain this way, the next person feels pain differently. Some people have a very high pain threshold, and others have a very low pain threshold, right? So how do you medicate somebody, right, for that too? Because it's subjective, right? And you can psych yourself up not to feel that pain, right? Or even olfaction. There was a story of a guy that served in the Korean War, an American guy, and his job was to actually get papers off of dead soldiers and to make sure that, you know, they didn't have some information that the other side could get. And so his job was to go on the dead soldiers and take off papers or anything that might be identifying, things like that. And he had to smell dead corpses and things. When he came back, he lost his sense of smell. Now, do you think he really lost his sense of smell if you gave him an odorant and you measure that neuron? He probably still had that smell, right? But he was so psychologically impacted by it, his perception, he couldn't smell anymore. And so some of these things might not be at the sensory level, but at a higher level, right? What if you had a tumor in that part of your brain for sensory perception, for touch on your skin? Those sensory neurons fire, but you don't perceive it. You don't have that perception, right? You don't recognize that. So it's very interesting when you think about sensory responses and how you respond to it and perceive it. And as we mentioned, there's lots of optical illusions out there. I think they're so cool. You can go online and just Google optical illusions, and you'll be wasting about 3 hours because there's so many fun things. I mean, you've probably all seen these things. This looks like, you know, if you start to look at it, the face, right? It's really a face. Or is it something you stand on the table? These dots are the same size, right? But it's all about perception around it. And animals use these sensory perceptions, right, to attract a mate or not. All kinds of neat little things about there with visual perception, the peacock, all that kind of stuff. All right, or even the fruit fly dance is amazing. Have you ever seen a fruit fly dance, mating dance? The male has to beat its wings around the female 4 times before the female is actually receptive. So if you damage a wing, then she won't be receptive. But at the same time, there's some sound waves that go along with that. So it's kind of interesting. So the multiple senses together, visual as well as the sound. And not only that, maybe for mating preference, but also avoidance. They now know that some of these little maggots, or larvae, if you will, that are injected by a parasitic wasp. A wasp will come and put its ovipositor into the larvae and inject an egg. Isn't that gross, you know? And then the egg will develop inside that larvae, and then the larvae dies, but then the egg hatches out and a new wasp is formed. So parasitic wasp, pretty cool. If anybody's in entomology, there's so many neat things in entomology. Oh, there's a super good seminar on Thursday over in the entomology department with brains and neuromodulation of insects, particularly like Drosophila and other insects over in entomology department, 3:30. So that's pretty cool. But anyways, for this parasitic wasp, these larvae actually, when the wasp comes, they noticed a weird behavior, that the larvae will start rolling and tumbling. So the parasitic wasp can't inject the egg into it. But how does it know that the parasitic wasp comes? Is it an odorant? What is it? So some researchers thought, maybe there's something to do with that wing beat, or maybe it's a vibration, the wind, you know, coming. So they put little puffs of wind on it, and it didn't roll. What would you do next, do you think? If you wanted to study that, what might you do next? And you say, who cares about larvae? You know? They keep you out the streets, you know, doing these weird experiments, right?
Do sound?
Pardon?
Sound?
Sound, yes, exactly. So they measured the wing frequency in the sound that it was giving, and they noticed that that caused a larger. So they used a speaker that could mimic that wing beat sound, and it's actually the frequency of the wind, of the beat, that caused the larvae to start rolling. So that's pretty cool. There's so many things with sound, for example, frogs that will, you know, chirp to find the mate, right? And then the female's responsive, so the male frog's chirping over here, and the female says, okay, you know, everything's good. Let's meet up and have coffee or something. Okay, so this one's chirping, but if you raise the temperature of this one, the sound production's different, and then the female won't respond. You raise the female up to the same temperature, now she responds. Lower the male to a lower temperature, and the female's at a higher temperature, and she won't respond. You lower this one down, then they respond. So it's not just the getting of the sound, the right signal, but it's also reception of that signal. That's pretty amazing, because the nervous system's going to change the frequency of that firing, because they're ectotherms, right? So that's pretty neat to think about. There's so many neat things out there we could spend a whole course on. We used to have a course on sensory systems, taught it about 4 years ago, but because we teach so many other things, we haven't been able to teach that, but we have a new faculty member that's in the department, Eve Schneider. She just started on January, and her whole focus is really on mechanosensory receptors. So it's going to be really cool that she's here, and we're going to resurrect that course again. But if you're graduating, you can just come back and take it. All right, it'd be so great. All right. Receptor potentials. Now I'm going to kind of flip through these PowerPoints relatively quickly. A lot of them have extra content on them or just text descriptions, but we can go straight to the figures to really understand some of these processes. So transduction process, whatever it is, let's say it's mechano, and it opens up a stretch-activated channel, graded response, and then we know wherever there's a high density of voltage-gated sodium channels, that's where the lowest threshold is for activating an action potential, right? So if we have a high density voltage gated sodium channels, boom, action potential travels up. It might be that the sensory receptor would release a chemical and then activate another cell, right? Like the neuron, just like a synapse, right? So that could happen too. And it depends on what might the process be. Maybe there's a stretch activated depolarization to let calcium in, right? Because calcium allows vesicles to fuse, right? And then as long as we can have vesicles fused, the transmitter is going to be released, and then a target cell can receive that. So multiple ways to transduce that signal, to relay it into the nervous system, to then go to higher centers. So how is it that we might perceive, you know, light touch or a deeper touch, right, or a light pain or a higher pain? The firing frequency of these cells, right, for our perception. So we can think of a light stimulus, are a stronger stimulus, depolarize it more, then you can have a higher firing frequency than, say, a light depolarization. And that will then be relayed onto the next neuron, next neuron, next neuron, until you get perception. So the firing frequency is important. And you think about what limits that firing frequency. We've talked about that before. What could be limiting the firing frequency of a neuron? How fast can you perceive, you know, touch? What frequency are you limited, do you think? Action potential goes up, action potential comes down, stimulate again, refractory period, right? The voltage-gated sodium channels are in that refractory period, absolute versus relative. Now, even if you're in the relative, you might not get a full action potential again, right? It's abortive. So maybe it doesn't travel down to the, you know, it doesn't get rejuvenated again. But if it's above a threshold to rejuvenate the action potential of the next node, it's myelinated, then it can get the next action potential. So think about the limitations and perception, right? But not just maybe that. Maybe it has to reset itself if these stretch-activated channels, sodium's rushing in, changes the membrane potential, you know, and it doesn't come back down to rest, but even some problems on driving gradient, right? So that's kind of an interesting process as well. Not to get too crazy with some of the details, but the general idea is tonic receptors really don't, and this is where this term gets misused sometimes. They use adaptation here not as a genetic, multiple generations, evolutionary process, but adapt. So it's not quite the same that we've been teaching about adaptation, right? For adapting the animal, but this is where it can be confusing. So usually it's referred to as tonic receptors don't adapt so quickly. They adapt slowly. But you can really say maybe accommodation, right? They don't accommodate so quickly, right? So that might be a better word. But this is where it gets confusing sometimes and people get confused with that. And phasic receptors can adapt very fast or accommodate very quickly. So those terms we're going to kind of use interchangeably. You might see those on old exams, accommodate versus adapt. Okay, so let's look at some of these things. So you can see here, this one is, this is a receptor potential up here. And this is a stimulus that you can inject current or maybe give a stimulus like touch. And you see that receptor potential stays and slowly accommodates or adapts. And when you turn it off, it comes back down because stretch-activated ion channels are open and sodium is rushing in, right? Whereas in this case, you touch it and it gives this depolarization, but then it accommodates. And only when you turn it back off do you get this response. So it's kind of interesting. These are like an on-off response, but it accommodates very rapidly. Oh, isn't that just a great picture? I'm going to just stay on that all afternoon, just stay and look at it, think of all these wonderful things in there. Amazing animal. But let's think about these wonderful little creatures. Okay, so if you look at something very interesting, we used to do this in the 350 labs, but we kind of got away from it because there were all these other labs that people wanted to do. I lost control. But we would just love it because we would do all our labs with crayfish. But anyway, this is a really cool one. If you're looking at your textbook, Eckert, the guy that wrote this one, he actually did this kind of work in the 1960s. This is really interesting because on the back of a crayfish, this is the back of it, if you look at these muscles right here, these muscles will attach across the segment, right? You remember these muscles? These are the ones you stabbed, right? But it was the other side around. And these were those long muscles that were there. But on the back, on the very back side, there's these two strands that go across like this. And there's two pairs. So there's two here and two here. If we did this lab, which is really quite fun too, a neuromuscular lab, if we stab some of the muscles in the belly region of the crayfish, these ones that are superficial right here, you put an electrode in there, and you have the animal pinned out, you'll get spontaneous firing of the nerve, and you get the spontaneous evoked responses that you measure in the muscle fiber. So the nerve is spontaneously active. And people wonder, why is it spontaneously active? So Eckert, you know, keep him off the streets. He was studying this stuff in the 1960s, and he was wondering what would drive that spontaneous activity. So he thought, well, maybe it's the joint receptors in the abdomen of the crayfish. So these are joint receptors. They span the joint. When the crayfish bends, it stretches these muscle fibers. And these little muscle fibers have sensory nerves in them. So he actually took that out of the animal, and then he could monitor the activity of that motor nerve through the ventral muscles, and he could stretch that muscles and wonder if the firing frequency changed on that motor nerve to those abdomen muscles. And he found out it didn't matter. But anyways, he tested his ideas, right? So it's kind of interesting. But why is this so neat? And why are we going off on a tangent? Well, these are these two muscles. These are really quite interesting because these muscles have a sensory neuron associated. One sensory neuron with each one of these muscles. So these are the pair. And if you look at it, it's really quite neat. You stretch these together, and this one fires the whole time. If we had speakers, which is really fun to do in the lab, then you would hear this. But the other one accommodates really quickly. Wow. Why is it the same stretch, but one accommodates so fast and the other one doesn't? NIH wants to give you $1 million to understand this basic fundamental principle. What would you do?
I remember you saying last time that the tonic has more mitochondria. Mm-hmm. So, think
about how I say the mitochondria. Yeah, to keep that activity going. So maybe it's the basic one running out of ATP? Maybe, something like that. Okay, any other ideas? A guy at Karolinska Institute studied this for a number of years. What's Karolinska? What does that ring a bell for you? In Sweden, in Stockholm.
Karolinska, the researchers, it's like, whoo! Karolinska is where they award the Nobel Prize in medicine and physiology every year, right? So a whole group was studying there for a long time on this particular system. And the reason they were studying this is because this is so fundamental to sensory transmission, right? If you can understand it in this system, we've got big cells, and you can easily look at this, then maybe you can get to the fundamental principles of these differences of tonic and phasic type of sensory receptors. And then we might understand how we function, right? The basic fundamental principles. So there's actually a book on this particular system, and this system is called the muscle receptor organ, or the MRO. People use this lab around the world. You could talk to somebody from Australia, Argentina, Iran, anywhere. They actually use this system in understanding these basic principles. It's a really wonderful system. And basically, curry fish are in every continent, except they haven't found them in Antarctica. But that people can gather them from their local environment and actually do these experiments in the labs. There was a high school in Korea that was actually doing this at Ewha University, a girls' college, and a girls' high school college. And so this is really quite neat. Because you can record, and it's a real easy lab, just put a suction electrode around here, and you can bend the abdomen of the crayfish, and you can study this. So, what other kind of experiments might you do? Maybe it's a mitochondria. What else do you think? You're stretching these muscle fibers, and when it comes, what's activating them? What's activating those sensory endings? Some kind of stretch, right? Stretch-activated ion channels. And this muscle's being stretched. So it has to be embedded in that muscle fiber, right, to sense that stretch. Where are we going? Is that an answer? Do you want an answer? No. Okay. Well, what activates the sensory endings? Stretch, right? So maybe the stretch isn't the same on it, right? Maybe there's some kind of elastic recoil of the muscle fiber. That makes sense? Possibilities? Maybe? Maybe those muscle fibers, they stretch, and they stretch on the sensory endings up there, but then somehow it kind of relaxes. It doesn't have the same force on the endings. It doesn't have the same force on these endings. And so you think, that's interesting. Maybe we can study that somehow. How could we study that? These are muscles. You see that little banding pattern? We haven't talked about it yet. But this banding pattern are the sarcomeres of a muscle. These are the muscle units that build up. So you can actually see the sarcomere banding pattern. So maybe by looking at the sarcomere structure, we can find out if it's relaxing more, or if it's stiffening up. Maybe the other one stays stiff, and the other one can move. So they actually looked at the sarcomere banding pattern and found that it didn't change. That's kind of interesting. They even wondered if the muscle might relax a little bit. So they put these little filings on it so they could have markers, and they took images of it when it would accommodate, and they found out that wasn't it either. And guess what? This particular preparation, the MRO, this cell body is gigantic. It is really large. You can see it with a hand lens if you stain it up with methylene blue. It is so big. This is why people wanted to work with it. So what could you do with large cell bodies? You could put an electrode in there, right? You can patch these things. You can see them so well. So people did do that. They put an electrode in here. And they put an electrode in there. And they measured the graded response. And they found out there's differences in the graded responses. And then they put drugs on it, like 4-aminopyridine, TEA, tetraethylammonium, that blocks potassium channels, TTX, that blocks the voltage-gated sodium channels, just like the squid stuff in the 1950s. And guess what they found out? There's a different density of the voltage-gated potassium channels in these two different neurons. And that different density or distribution of the potassium channels is what's responsible for one accommodating faster than the other. Now, why is that so interesting? This preparation, also the MRO, when you look at those figures in your textbook of the dendrites, right, and a neuron that they show you, the typical dendrites, right, and a cell body, and the axon hillock, and what's at the axon hillock right there? Site of spike initiation, voltage-gated sodium channels that you see in every textbook. Guess where that figure came from? This preparation. Because they could do intracellular recordings. That's how important this preparation is.
right? Really quite neat. But not only that, there's something else that's interesting. What are all these things? These are motor neurons that innervate this muscle fiber. And some of these are excitatory motor neurons, and some of these are actually inhibitory motor neurons. Woo! This is an invertebrate. This is that crustacean preparation. Glutamate for the excitatory, GABA for the inhibitory. So why does it need this? This is really interesting. Why is this so interesting? Because this is your muscle now. This is mammalian preparation. How do you sense when you close your eyes, you know you moved your hand out like this. You know you moved your finger back and forth, right? You know if you put your, close your eyes and you touch your two fingers together, you know where your arms are to do that. How do you perceive that? By your muscles. Not joint receptors, but by your muscles. And in your muscles, you have these things that are embedded, like that little capsule right there. So here's your big extrafusal muscle. Then there's this little capsule inside. And if you take that capsule and you open it up and look at it, it looks like this. You got this big muscle fiber in that capsule, and you got a smaller one. And guess what happens if you stimulate these? Let's draw it out. It is so cool. Okay, let's see if we get this thing. So, what you can do is you can... Does that work? Yes. You can stretch it. Let's record from A. Let's record from B, two different nerves. Let's do a a suction electrode or a hook electrode. And you record in this one, and you're going to get firing. Extracellular recordings, right? Because why? In the mammalian preparation... Look, where's the cell body for these sensory neurons? In a mammalian preparation like you, and your muscle spindles that are in your big toe, where's the cell body for it? If you wanted to study how you perceive where your toe's moving back and forth, or your limbs are moving, where's the cell body for this sensory neuron? Is it down by your toe? Is it in the muscle fiber, like that crayfish one, right by the sensory endings? It's way up in your dorsal root ganglion. And you got this dorsal root ganglion, and now you have 1,000 cell bodies in there. Which one should I put an electrode in to try to study those proprioceptors in my big toe? Right? You got the big problem, right? So the crayfish preparation gave you that ability to study a single sensory neuron right there where you're stretching it, understanding these basic principles. Now for us, we would have to have that greater responsive fire, the action potential down there that travels up and goes into your spinal cord. So, but if you recorded right there at the nerve, leaving that muscle, you would record something like this. And this other one would do something like that. Well, what does that remind you of? Right? Just like the crayfish preparation, right? Two sensory nerves, one wraps around this what's called nuclear bag, and the other one wraps around the nuclear chain. And why are they called that? Because one actually looks like, if you looked at this thing, one looks like a little bag-shaped thing, and the other one looks more like a chain, okay? So you got the bag and the chain, and there's sensory endings wrapping around these, right? And those are inside of your muscles, these little spindle-like things. But they're very hard to record. You can't record in the sensory ending with an intracellular electrode, right? So you use other preparations. So by inference, we think this might be the way we function with the sensory perception, just the same way the crayfish does. But has it been directly recorded with an intracellular electrode? No. Right? So we don't still understand exactly what's going on there, but we can make an inference by that. All right? So now we have this muscle, the little spindle that's inside this big muscle, and we stretched it. So you stretch your arm. Now, if we stretch that out, what happened? That's stretched, right? But now I'm going to relax my arm. Now what happened to that little spindle that's in there and those muscle fibers? We stretched it, and now we moved your arm back, and now they're going to be what? Flaccid, right? They're not going to be that. So maybe it's the other muscle that can respond because it's like agonist, antagonist, right? Muscles. But how could we perceive it again if we wanted to just stretch it after it was flaccid and stretched? But how flaccid is it going to be before it doesn't respond at all, right? Does it quit firing? Does it always kind of fire like, when you move it? So what people have found out is that really interesting. there are motor neurons that innervate these little muscles that are inside that spindle. These are motor neurons. And these are called gamma motor neurons in us, in mammals. These are called gamma motor neurons. Okay? Versus alpha motor neurons. Alpha motor neurons innervate your big muscles, your extrafusal muscles. These are called interfusal muscles. So your extrafusal muscles are those big muscles that you're moving, right? And these are interfusal muscles. So you have gamma motor neurons that innervate the interfusal muscles. You have alpha motor neurons that innervate the big muscles around this. So what's interesting is when this becomes stretched out, and when you're moving it back to become flaccid, but the other, this muscle has to contract for that, right? That when you fire that, you fire the gamma motor neurons, and they tighten this up. So these can keep this tight, taut, the whole time. And so now when you stretch it again, it will fire. So it's pretty amazing to have these two working together. If you look at the cross-section of the spinal cord, in case you ever get this, I don't think you will, but if you ever saw it, remember this kind of thing? The butterfly? Psychology test? All right. So your alpha motor neurons are down here in the ventral horn, right? Your gamma motor neurons are much smaller in cell body size. Remember, these are where your cell bodies are. They're much smaller, but they're mixed in, and they're a little bit offset from the alpha motor neuron cell bodies. Okay, but they're still in this ventral horn. So they can actually separate these out with dye filling, and they communicate to each other. The way that these are firing, you're going to have to fire those too. So there's what they call the gamma loop. This is what's referred to, if you ever hear of the gamma loop, this is it. And making sure your gamma motor neurons are in sync with your alpha motor neurons to keep the muscle spindle taut. And that's how you have proprioception. Isn't that amazing? This is how you work and understand. It's not your joints, because you know, if you had a knee replacement, they get you up the next day, right? After the knee replacement, the hip replacement, and you can walk just fine. You're not much stumbling. You know, it's painful, but you know. The thing is that your proprioception, understanding how your limbs move and your joints, are by these muscle spindles. And we have a little lab demo, don't give it away, other guys, that you will do in the lab for this. Okay, so that's pretty neat. Pretty neat. And guess what? The crayfish preparation is the same way. These motor neurons fire to keep that muscle taut when it relaxes. So the same situation is in this muscle receptor organ, but there's something even more unique about the crayfish system is that it has inhibitory motor neurons in there too. It can release GABA right onto the muscle fiber and actually inhibit that muscle fiber so it doesn't depolarize, so it won't contract. So pretty amazing. So, yes?
Sorry.
Nope, go
so
ahead.
So when these motor neurons in the crayfish, when they fire the inhibitory and the inhibitory, what are they specifically doing?
They're either making that muscle taut. So if you relax that joint and you relax, you didn't stretch anymore, you relaxed it, those muscles would be like a rubber band. If you pulled on the rubber band and then you let it go together, what's going to happen? It's going to not have any more stretch in. So think of that rubber band with like sensory endings in there. But when you pulled it together and it's flaccid, how can you keep it taut? Well, these motor neurons will fire and contract that muscle to keep it taut. And now those sensory neurons can respond to any more stretch. Right? They'll be very sensitive. So it's always keeping up the tone of these muscles so it can be very sensitive to any further movement. So it's a pretty amazing system. And that was all worked out in your crayfish abdomen preparation, which we still use today to try to understand our proprioception after your sensory endings. So pretty amazing. Some people that lose proprioception, we could talk about the spinal cord, for example. Remember we talked about... dorsal root ganglion, right? Which is, you'll see it in lab. It's this structure that's outside of the spinal cord. All the sensory nerves that come in there, the cell bodies are up here. And people are beginning to try to separate these out and understand more about them. Now with imaging techniques and dyes, you can find out which ones are firing when you like activate the skin of the mouse, for example, and you can look at which ones fire. Imaging technology has just made it amazing. But, you know, if you look at these and you count them from in humans or in rodents, you actually lose these after birth. You're losing them throughout your lifespan. You actually lose cell bodies in here in your dorsal root ganglion throughout your life. What are we losing? What sensory perceptions are we losing? Tactile? Pain? What's going on? They've done these studies and correlative studies throughout humans on cadavers and actually found out there's fewer and fewer the older you get. And the same thing follows in mammalian systems. So it's really quite interesting. What are we losing as we get older? Are they proprioceptors? Are they pain receptors? Are they touch receptors? What are they, right? So it's kind of interesting. But this whole process, the coming in for proprioception, it comes into the dorsal horn. And then these proprioceptor neurons, if you've had another anatomy course, for example, you might know that these outside, the white matter outside here, is where tracts run up and down the spinal cord, right? But these actually run up in a special little region in the spinal cord. So it's kind of interesting. They know the tracts that they run in to go to the higher spots in your brain. But that tract is very close to descending information or other information for like pain reception, for pain, separate from like tactile. So if somebody has like cancer pain, bone cancer in their leg, for example, well, what are you going to do for pain, right? Or they have this cancer pain. Well, one idea is to jack them up with opioids, right? But that's no good. Constipated, can't function, can't go around. So some ideas are actually go in the spinal cord and cut the pain receptors. That's a good idea because you can't then perceive it, right, anymore. So you can go for that leg that's having chronic pain that you can't even function, maybe bone cancer in there or something while you're getting treated, and let's just cut the pain out. So they go in and they actually cut that. The problem with some of the earlier work, when they cut these pain receptors, they cut neurons that go down, like controlling the motor neurons, but also the proprioceptors input. So that caused some problems. So knowing those tracks specifically where you are is really important. So what they do is they actually put electrodes in these regions and can move a leg and find out exactly where they're cutting, if they're cutting too much or did they cut the pain out, right? And keep you semi-conscious with this whole process. So it's really an amazing field if you get into the areas of understanding some of these concepts that people are looking at. Really cool stuff. Okay, so let's continue on. I got off on tangents. I'm so far behind. Okay, so muscle receptors in us are important for proprioception, just like the crayfish. And the same idea, these kind of tonic and phasic firing. So that's why we love crayfish, because they're so cool, right? So we're like little crayfish. All right, so receptive fields. When we start, as I mentioned, we're jumping around quite a bit. So receptive fields, like for touch, how is it that that sensory neuron, how much skin area is it going to perceive? That would be the receptive field. It's no different than your visual perceptive field. How is that sensory cell in the back of your retina, what area is it perceiving out in your visual field? That's the receptive field for it. Okay, so when we talk about receptive fields, we're talking about that area that that particular neuron responds to. Okay, so some receptive fields, as we'll mention in the lab, and you will demonstrate, we'll demonstrate this in the lab, might be smaller or larger receptive fields, meaning that more sensory endings invading that part of the skin, for example, from that one neuron. And then you can relate that to the perception in the cortex in the brain where we actually detect that. And so that's pretty neat. Some of these perceptions are not all in the higher center, but they might be localized right on the skin, for example, or in the retina itself. And the retina itself, when we get to that point, it's like a little brain. It's amazing. There are whole courses just in understanding the retina because it's so complex. But some interesting aspects with this is lateral inhibition. So a lot of this has worked out in a horseshoe crab. We'll get to this point, but I'll just mention it here, for example. So if you give a stimulus here in the mid region, you can see that that neuron fires the most, right? Because you gave that pencil right there. And that one's firing. But if you actually gave a stimulus to the side that was stronger than that one right here, it would inhibit this one, and you would then sense this. Because there's this communication back and forth, lateral inhibition. Now we'll talk about this when we get to the retina, or in the horseshoe crab eye, but the concept of lateral inhibition then gives you that perception exactly where that stimulus is coming from. Okay? So this is... When we get to the eye, too, this is what gives you the greatest ability to sense contrast, like edge contrast. If you look at objects, that edges is really because of lateral inhibition that you can detect these edges really well. So the concept here is lateral inhibition to give you the highest acuity where that stimulus is coming from. That's the take-home. All right. So touch receptors, as we mentioned over and over again, there's so many interesting types, but this Purcinian corpuscle is a typical one that people like to study because of the interesting aspects of why does it accommodate. You touch this, and you get a firing, but you maintain the touch, and the firing is not there anymore. So what is this rationale? Is it due to those potassium channel differences, or is it something to do with this structure around the sensory? So we talked about the differences of basic and tonic in the crayfish and probably in your proprioceptors. This is a different type of accommodation. This one has to do with the accessory structure around the sensory input. So the best way to think about this is like an onion. You have an onion, and you stab a pencil in that onion. But the onion's a little old, right? And so the layers of the onion kind of move around. So you put this pencil, and that pencil is the sensory ending. You touch the onion, those layers push down on the pencil tip, right? And open up stretch-activated ion channels, graded response, and then boom, if it goes so far, then it fires an action potential. But those onion layers, because it's an old onion, they're kind of moving around. And they don't give that same perception onto that sensory ending. So it's accommodating, right? And now it's not going to have these stretch-activated ion channels open anymore because the accessory structure has moved, right? The accessory structure has moved, and it's not giving the same mechano-stimulation onto it. I thought I had a better picture of this thing somewhere. No, I guess not. Okay. So the take-home here is with the Purcinian corpuscle. If you've actually measured the graded response here, you could see that you would have a depolarization when you push on this, and then it comes back down, right? Because it's not maintaining the fire. If you take away the onion layers, and now you push directly on the sensory ending, and you look at the graded response, it stays up. Meaning if you can still activate those stretch-activated channels and keep it going if you push directly on the sensory ending. So the point, the take-home here is these onion layers move around and that accessory structure is what's causing the off response. And then when you take your hand off of your skin, you feel it again. Like if you pushed on your skin, you can feel when you kind of touch and then you lose that perception. You take your finger off and you'll sense that, right? So this is the way it's happening because when they take the stimulus off the onion layers, then it has to restructure again and it causes a deformation of that sensory ending and then it fires that neuron. So it's an on-off type of response. Okay. So many interesting things out there. If you looked at your skin, you know, like I said, the single hair movement, look at the way the sensory ending is embedded around the hair. So when you deflect that hair one way or the other, what is it doing? Stretch activated ion channels. Isn't that amazing? Just by deflecting that hair one way or the other, you're opening up stretch activated ion channels. How about a little touch on the skin, very surface, you know, light touch. Deeper touch, remember these Purcinian corpuscles for deeper touch. Then you have ones that might detect the pain or temperature that are on the surface of your skin. Or the pain receptors, right? You touch your skin, you feel it at first. And then you pinch your skin, and then it's different, right? Now it's pain perception, right? So activating the pain receptors and nociceptors takes a higher stimulus to activate those neurons. But again, stretch-activated ion channels, right? Really painful. Okay, what are we into? So some other type of sensory receptors are really quite interesting. We didn't talk about the Golgi tendon organs before, but I want you to think about this too. So not just the muscle spindles that are in your muscles, right, the ones we just talked about, but where your muscles join the tendon, and the tendon then joins your bone, at that myotendinous junction, you have what are called Golgi tendon organs, named after the guy Golgi, Golgi stain, Golgi, right? So these Golgi tendon organs detect the stretch, the force on the tendon. And you might wonder, why are those important? Anybody have an idea why those are important? Why do you think those are important? So you don't damage yourself. You ever see weightlifters lifting the heavy weight? They're lifting it up, and all of a sudden they have to just drop. These Golgi tendon organs are thought to give a negative feedback back on the alpha motor neurons. So if they fire too high, they will inhibit the alpha motor neurons. To do what? Protect the muscle fibers from tearing, right? That's pretty amazing. That's the general idea, what they think that these Golgi tendon organs actually do. Now, what's really interesting, guess what? In the teeth of those crayfish, those claws that you were always afraid of touching, you can push on even on the teeth, and, you know, it will, you know, want to snap down. There's actually kind of a reflex that if you touch in there, they'll want to snap down. But if you push really hard when they're closing down and you can force really hard, they will actually lift up. There are stress detectors in the cuticle of those teeth of the claws that if you push too hard on the cuticle right there, they will actually lift up because they don't want to break the cuticle. Isn't that kind of interesting? They know not to go crushing too hard or to damage that cuticle. There's actually stretch detectors in the crayfish limbs also. We'll get to those a little bit later. Like Golgi tendon organs that are amazing. So we have to understand the Golgi tendon organs, muscle spindles in us, and now like these statocysts that detect sensation. You have them in your head. You know when your head's sideways, unless you're sleeping. And then you know how you're moving, right? And then if you're on a boat, right, and you're going to seasick, right? Is it from the statocyst or is it a visual problem? Anybody seasick when you get on a boat? Right? Anybody travel a boat? Right? Is it, what do you do when you're seasick? Go to the edge. No, I mean, you know, sometimes they say look at the horizon, right, for your visual responses instead of just looking at something moving in front of you and having that. You can get seasick by watching things move in front of you. Some people get seasick like looking in a microscope and moving slides around. They get nauseous from that, actually, because of the visual stimulus. Other points might be your statocyst or your equilibrium in your inner ear, and we'll talk about those. So statocysts are really quite important. They can detect this gravitational movement or your head where its position is, static positions. But also lobsters have these, and these are really quite cool. They're at the base of the antenna, these long antenna. This one, at the base of this antenna is this little structure that has sensory neurons embedded in this mucus layer, and those sensory neurons are embedded in this membrane, and there's this little statolith, like a little stone, that sits on this. So the stone has gravitational pull, right? So it's going pushing down. So this lobster knows if it's going up or down in total darkness, right? Because these statoliths can detect if its head's up or not. Now, when they molt, they actually change their exoskeleton, and when they molt, they add more calcium to this statolith. And what people have done, they love to torture poor little lobsters and crayfish, but they've actually given iron filings to the animal, so it ingests that, and guess what? These iron filings will be embedded in here when it molts. So now they have a magnet reception on it, so you can actually take a magnet underneath the animal and turn it on, and now they think they're going down, or they're face down, and they change their locomotion, or you can raise it above them, and now they think that they're going up, so they change their movement pattern just by that magnet field that changes the statoliths. So pretty interesting to try to understand these. Why is that important, do you think, on this crustacean preparation? What happens on the International Space Station? What happens to these astronauts? Yeah, they don't go up and down, right? There's still some gravity, but not very much. And so what happens if you wanted to live in outer space? What's going to happen to your perception? What's going to happen to your gravity sensation, right? What's going to happen to if you're born in space, for example, what's going to happen with the sensory projections into that part of the brain? What's going to happen up there? What happens when an astronaut comes back down? Is there plasticity that maybe the wiring has changed? Are the perceptions changed? So pretty interesting to think about. So actually NASA funded a lot of this work on statocysts, and they funded some work actually in cockroaches that we'll talk about a little bit later too. Some pretty neat aspects. But some other reasons this is important. Let's just jump to this real fast while I'm here. I think we have it. We don't have it on the slide. Oh, horrible. Okay, so you have two structures, just like these statocysts. I'm going to jump ahead. You have in this region right here, in the utriculus and the sacculus, right? Well, they're here, right here. Utriculus and the sacculus, these little cavities in your inner ear. This is in your inner ear, right? In mammalian inner ear. You have right here, like where you see these sensory endings, you have something that's just analogous to that lobster system. You have a membrane, you have a mucus on it, you have a little stone that's on that. And then those sensory endings go out and they detect for you when your head is sideways, up front, or back. Not the movement, but the static positions. That's pretty cool. What happens if you have a head injury, for example? You got your exam back, you hit your head against the wall, don't do that. But if you did fall off something and you actually hit your head really hard, you can actually dislodge the statocyst from that membrane, and then what's going to happen to you? You have an altered perception. And this can happen to people. We know a person this happened to, a student, former student, actually, with a head injury, and she couldn't read anymore. She couldn't read her textbook. She couldn't function, couldn't drive. Took over a year for her to get this back, and they thought she had some higher injury. And finally, after about 4 neurologists, and then finally they realized it was really her statocyst came loose from her membrane. And 4 neurologists went through this. And they didn't figure it out until they finally got somebody that knew what they were doing for the test. But when they tested that, the last one said, well, this is a standard test. I don't know why everybody missed this. And so this is kind of interesting. So they put her into Cardinal Hill, and they actually had therapy where you had to lay on your side for so long and couldn't move, and to try to heal that back up with gravity that would push down, and it would heal over time. But it took a year before that could really happen, and so she could get back perception again, so she could read a textbook, could drive again, could walk around without being motion sick or on medication so much that all these side effects were happening. So you get the idea of why that's important to really understand. This can happen with head injuries. But, you know, get some right people that can do the right test. So it's really quite interesting, but a lot of understanding of that came from the lobster preparation, actually. So it's really quite interesting. Okay. These other kind of perceptions are really kind of interesting along the fish, the lateral line. You've probably heard of a lateral line on the fish. Let's go through a little bit of that. These are really amazing little sensory structures. And we're going to make an analogy to that to you again. And so it's really amazing. If you look at along the side of the fish, next time you pick one up or something, look at that lateral line. It's really an amazing structure. It's got these little holes like in the skin, but it's got these little ampullas, like little capsules sitting there in this line. If you blow that up, it looks like this. This is really amazing. These are called hair cells, and we'll talk about why. It's a single cell, so these are single cells, and on these single cells, have these little projections out of them. The smaller ones are called stereocilia, and the larger one is called a kinocilium. And they now know from recording from single cells like this that if you bend one direction towards the kinocilium or away from the kinocilium, you can either activate this cell or inhibit this cell. That's pretty amazing. So depending on which direction this moves, you either excite it or inhibit. There's little bridges between these kinocilium and then the stereocilia, like little bridges that go between those. So this is one cell, and then it releases transmitter onto a receptive field across the synapse, and then that neuron goes to the animal's brain. Why is this important? This can detect the fluid movement across the animal. So when it's swimming or water's moving across it, it's going to deflect this little capsule and fire it so the animal knows which way the water's going across the animal or how fast it's swimming. Okay, that's really neat. And you saw these kind of little bridges right here and going between the kinocilium and stereocilium. And again, like we said, opens up calcium channels. Then the calcium comes in, causes vesicles to fuse, and then release the transmitter and then respond to the secondary cell. Why is that so important? Well, let's look at your inner ear. Let's look at your semicircular canals that detect rotational movement of your head when you're moving your head. Okay? If we look at these semicircular canals, you know these three, they're really quite amazing. People have built computational models with this to detect. Exactly. It's really quite amazing the way this structure is, so you can detect all positions of your head movement. But at the base of these semicircular canals are filled with the fluid, right? Indolent. They're filled with the fluid. And when that moves, that fluid moves, guess what it does? It pushes over this ampulla. And if you look at the ampulla, this is no different than the lateral line in the fish. It's the same structure. Right? So now, movement across there, and it can detect that, which way you're moving your head. So a standard type of test that a neurology might do, what happens with fluid movements in hot or cold water? It's going to have a convection current, right? So you can put cold water in an ear or warm water in one ear, and it will cause that fluid to start moving, and then you're going to start to bend. Very stereotypic type of behavior that you have. So the cold water, warm water in your ear is really something that you can get this response. You're going to have an altered perception that your head's moving and you can actually fall over. So it's kind of an interesting test. So next time your partner tells you to take a cold shower, you have an excuse not to touch your ears. I'm joking. Okay. Just to keep you alive. All right. So because some people actually pass out when they get cold water put on one side and not the other, so you can sense that directly. Or even like you're out playing around in the snow and the ice and stuff like that, and you get cold water in your divers. Anybody scuba dive? Scuba diving in a lake or in cold water, there's scuba divers that get very nauseous. And they actually lose orientation, and instead of going up, they go down. They've lost complete perception, and they die because of this, and they think it's because of this reason. So that's why they wear hoods. Sometimes they wear plugs in their ears so they won't get water in there. And that's another reason to trust your devices and not your perception. Your devices are telling you what's going up. You're going down or up. And people, actually, that's why you always dive with a partner too, right? But if the problem is that they can have an altered perception and they think up is down. And they're going down when they should be going up. So some real issues with that. But it's standard neurological test. And you can buy a nice book if you're really interested in neurology about neurology testing. And they're so cool because these kind of things go on like that. Or even the tilt test and, where your platform moves. So what happens if you hit your head and you cracked your skull? And inside your skull, there's a sac called an endolymph sac that makes this fluid, that puts this fluid into your semicircular canals and everything. But what if you cracked your skull and you damaged that little sac and it leaked out? You haven't damaged the sensory neurons, but you change the fluid in there, so you lose perception, right? And you not only lose that perception, but that fluid's also around the sacculus and your trichulus. So now you've lost static position, and you've lost knowing what's going on. Maybe on one side compared to the other. So what's that going to do to your brain? You're just in chaos, right? You don't know what's going on. And so you become very disoriented. So was it a brain injury higher up? Did you have a really concussion, a brain injury? No, you just cracked your skull, right? So you can see that the test would have to go through to find out what's going on. And they can do these kind of water tests or x-rays can see that crack, but sometimes it's such a hairline crack that they can't tell. Or something that we didn't tell you, it's going to make you blow your mind, actually endolymph is very high in potassium. Very high in potassium. Extracellular fluid higher in potassium. And actually when you change this sensory, it actually is the potassium that comes into the cells. It's kind of an interesting process. If people are low in potassium, the endolymph potassium concentration is different, and they have an altered perception as well. So it's very interesting process in there. So complex. So really quite neat. All right, so we've gone through the otolith, semicircular canals, generally the idea of this. And this vestibular nerve here, not only for movement perception, but for static position too, right? So that vestibular nerve goes into your brain and then tells your brain what's going on. It's a phenomenal aspect. Now, this is just for movement and static position. What about the snail-like structure? The snail-like structure, the cochlea, is actually for hearing. And that's an amazing structure, too. So let's think about this. This is the round window and the oval window and how all this works. Let's go to the big ear. Okay, we've already talked about all this. Here's that... The utriculus and sacculus in mammals, it's the same idea that we just talked about in the lobster, where they sit, the sacculus and utriculus, with those little stones on top of the gelatin mass. Depending on how you move your head, it moves the gelatin mass, causes those hair cells to deflect, and that's how you detect perception. So when you think about the perception that you perceive, it's really quite amazing, right? Your ears, your inner ears, your static position, your movement of your muscles, you can tell where your things are. But some people that maybe have lost proprioception, they had those nerves cut in their spine, or they have some damage, spinal damage, and they've lost perception to their legs. They don't know where their legs are. That'd be pretty bad, wouldn't it? That'd be bad. Guess what they can do? And they can walk just fine. What would you do? What would you think? Hint, hint, hint. They just get out of the bed and they just fall down because they don't know where their legs are.
Is this like the mirror therapy?
Kind of. All they have to do is look at their legs, look at their feet, and they can walk perfectly fine. But they have to look at their feet all the time. As soon as they take their eyes off, they lost where their legs are. Isn't that amazing? So they can use the visual system to override and understand where their legs are by using vision. I think that's just phenomenal. It shows you the redundancy in the system that's out there. So it's amazing kind of stuff. So, you know, get the general idea. I don't want you to have to memorize everything here, but just the general idea. Okay, where are we? There was something else I was going to mention that I got on a tangent. Oh, yeah, we'll come to the hearing in a second. Okay. More sound traveling, kind of working up in simpler animals up to higher animals. Some animals can hear sound around them, like the vibrations, right? And you wonder, how are you hearing me? Yeah. But the fish can hear too, and it's really quite amazing. They have a swim bladder in them, helps them with their buoyancy, and we'll talk about it later when we get to respiration, but they can actually add gas to their swim bladder and change their buoyancy. But the swim bladder, this big air-filled sac inside of the animal, imagine them swimming in the water and some vibration coming in the water pushing on their body, right? And that big air sac, what's going to happen? It's going to move. And attached to that air sac are these little bones called Weber bones. And they can actually go and relay the signal, the vibration from the swim bladder into the animal, and actually that movement of the bones detects the animal, the vibration around the animal. It's very interesting, but again, that movement, vibration movement onto the bones and then activating neurons. So let's kind of go to this step right here. How is it that you hear? Your external ear, you get a sound wave that comes in, right? Sound wave comes in, hits that tympanic membrane, which is really quite amazing. And that tympanic membrane has the three smallest bones in your body, the malleus, incus, stapes, named by their structure, like a malleus, incus, and a stapes on a, you know, horse kind of thing. So this malleus, incus, stapes moves, so they get the movement of the tympanic membrane moving these three bones, and then these three bones, so this is your outer ear, middle ear, moving a little window that we call right here, this oval window, pushing on fluid inside of the cochlea. This is that snail-like structure. That fluid gets pushed on, and now it sets a mechanical wave in the fluid. And that fluid now moves and goes all the way around, and then there's another little window here called the round window, where it can be dissipated. We used to have a model. I left it at some school somewhere, and I never got it back. But anyway, what we had was a plastic model where you could see through the pipe and put a feather in there, right? And you had a feather, and one of the models was that they're sealed on both ends, and there's fluid inside. So you move the pipe back and forth, and the feather's going to be there, and the fluid moves with the pipe, right? So it's like this. Now take one of those ends off and put a flexible membrane, like plastic wrap, and now you move it, and now you see when the water hits that plastic wrap, it moves. So it causes the feather to move this way. Now put a plastic wrap on both sides and that pipe, and now you move it back and forth like that, and the water goes this way and that way and this way and that way. And what happens to the feather? Back and forth like that, right? That's what's happening inside of here. And having the two windows allows that fluid to move both directions, where you can really set up the wave that goes all the way around. So that is really very cool. And so now if we take a cross-section through here, it looks like this. That cross-section, fluid's moving through here, it's going around to the end and coming back around and coming down this direction. But what's happening in that little cross-section is this amazing little structure, this little V-like structure. And just as we're going to stop here, when this fluid moves back and forth right here, it causes this membrane to move, and then it causes this tectorial membrane to move, and that tectorial membrane is sitting on top of those hair cells. So when the tectorial membrane, think of my elbow as a hinge, moving it back and forth. So that fluid movement causes that tectorial membrane to move, which then moves the hairs. It's phenomenal. We'll come back to this on Thursday. We're going to try to wrap up the sensory chapter on Thursday, and I mean it's going to roll, right? So maybe look at the PowerPoints, maybe read the chapters. We're cruising.